please. I now know how people feel in movie theatres, regular theatres, when they're trying to get the play to start on time and the audience is still drifting in and getting very upset if they don't get time to take their seats. So I think we can just about start. I was trying to look for a common theme in this session, and I was hoping that I would get a nice introductory title for the session from the organisers, but with great creativity, they've entitled this session Recent Cases. So I did look at them to see what I could find that they had in common other than their relevance to constitutional law. And I wondered also why they'd asked me to chair this session. I realised that the one thread that is that these cases have in common is that I'm related to a counsel that argued in all three. Our first speaker is Associate Professor Graham Orr from the University of Queensland, who's going to speak on the right to vote in Australia, the case of Roach and the Electoral Commissioner. Dr. Orr is an Associate Professor in the University of Queensland Law School. He specialises in the law regulating politics, elections and parties, so he's been quite busy. He authored the report on Australian electoral systems, How Well Do They Serve Political Equality, and co-edited Realising Democracy, Electoral Law in Australia. He's currently working on an account of electoral law in Australia for Federation Press. He did his PhD in the regulation of electoral bribery, so some of you may wish to speak to him afterwards. This presentation that he's going to give now explains the High Court's reasoning in Roach, both in its implications for the narrow issue of prisoner voting rights and in what it reveals more broadly about what he describes as the Court's cautious approach to constitutional democracy. Professor Orr.
You can see that I'm a teacher champing at the bit for a new semester. I produced some PowerPoints. I can't guarantee there'll be any powerful points that I have to make. Roach was a somewhat picturesque case in its facts and in the limited range of issues that were on the table, and yet it does raise some fundamental questions about the role of the courts and the Constitution vis-à-vis the role of the Parliament in shaping what I would call the law of democracy. Just by way of background, this is a George Williams conference, so we have to at least bemoan the fact that Australia has no Bill of Rights, and therefore Australia has no explicit constitutionalised right to vote as such. But even in those countries that have an explicit guarantee of the franchise, it's usually in the form something like you'd find in Article 25 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, a statement that individuals to be guaranteed participation in elections subject to reasonable restrictions. And this idea of reasonable restrictions means that even in nations like Canada and so on that have their charters, issues such as the boundary drawing of the minimum voting age, or to what degree should expatriates be franchised, or should even resident non-citizens have a right to vote, those issues are going to be alive in countries that have a charter and possibly in countries like Australia that don't. As you'll know, Section 7 and 24 require the Commonwealth Parliament to be directly chosen by the people, but in contradistinction to that, sections like Section 8 and Section 30 in particular say that qualifications of electors is to be up to Parliament. And prior to Roach, it was generally presumed, I think, that the franchise was essentially something to be shaped by Parliament. Parliamentary sovereignty approach, subject perhaps to some extreme limits. For example, in McKinlay's case, Justices McTiernan and Jacobs in dicta suggested that any attempt to wind back the clock to pre-federation or pre the 1902 Uniform Franchise Act to exclude large classes of the population would be liable to be subject to be struck down, at least by Justices McTiernan and Jacobs. But in McKinlay's case, you had the alternative position being put quite strongly by, for example, Chief Justice Barwick, that through an original intent reading, we see that at Federation, it was explicitly the question of the universality of suffrage was left to the political process, left to federal parliament. And we know, for example, historically, that Indigenous citizens were not generally enfranchised until 1962. So we've got this tension between two potential approaches. One where the courts will say we'll be the boundary riders of any undue winding back or limitations on the franchise, versus an idea this is a matter for Parliament and the political process to resolve, even though, of course, we know that politicians will have a significant degree of self-interest in the way they frame the laws of democracy and elections particularly. On the more particular issue that this case was rooted in, prisoner disenfranchisement, broadly speaking, we could say that conservatives tend to be against the idea of prisoners being enfranchised, and their arguments tend to come from one of two wings. One is a social contractarian style argument. The other is peel the veneer away, and it's a law and order style argument. Conversely, people on the left of politics or progressives tend to be in favour of enfranchising prisoners for one of two reasons. The principle of universality of representation, particularly in a system, after all, that you can go to jail for not voting in Australia if you don't pay your fines. But secondly, a more touchy-feel idea that ensuring prisoners have the right to vote is treating them as citizens and may have some, at least minor, rehabilitative effect in the long term. In reality, the issue doesn't cut a lot of mustard in terms of deciding the outcomes of elections. This is in Florida. It is essentially a symbolic question, a question about expressive values. But for all its symbolism, such as the way, such as the metaphors that we live and run politics by, that its limited practical importance makes it an even bigger issue in the game of what we might call political football or the tug of war between conservatives and progressives, out of all proportion to its significance to the electoral system and its outcomes. To give you a potted summary of federal disenfranchisement of provisions, there was a period of great stability between the Uniform Franchise Act in 1902, when anyone serving a sentence for an offence punishable by 1 year or more, roughly like the definition of a felony, were not granted the franchise in 1902. Then we see the Labor government under Prime Ministers Hawke and Keating expanding the prisoner franchise in two steps in 1983 and 1995. And then in a kind of reversal of the tug of war, we saw the Conservative government under Prime Minister Howard reining the prisoner franchise in quite severely, such as in 2006, effectively, if you were serving any sentence of imprisonment, you wouldn't have the franchise. The result in Roach, as I'm sure Anne Toomey told you this morning, was that we've now flipped back to the status quo prior to the 2006 winding back. What Labor will do, if anything, in the future, I'm not sure. If Senator Faulkner were here, we could ask him. It is traditionally Labor policy to enfranchise all prisoners, but I'm not sure they'll, especially under the Rudd government, think it's worth the candle in terms of the kinds of headlines that the tabloid press luxuriate in when the prisoner franchise was being enhanced in 1983 and 1995. Headlines such as "Killers to Get the Vote" were commonplace, at least in the state I came from, which, replete with a picture of a female murderess, quite hard to find, to sexualise the issue as well. But these headlines tell us something of the continuation, perpetuation of the idea of that the prisoners, in a sense, have tainted blood, and somehow that tainted blood is going to contaminate the electoral process, that somehow it's unfair that law-abiding citizens' votes have the same weight or say as people have been sentenced to incarceration. On to the specifics of Roach's case. The facts are really in quite short compass. Vicky Roach was an Indigenous woman, carefully chosen, being a woman and an Indigenous person, although the court didn't pay much attention to the kinds of indirect discrimination arguments on some of the social fact evidence that the plaintiffs sought to adduce. Ms. Roach was subject to a six-year sentence for some quite serious offences, burglary, negligent endangerment. She was also chosen, I guess, in part because it was quite clear she had voting capacity and interest. She was part of a group of people or a group of prisoners who couldn't be said they should be excluded because they had absolutely no capacity to understand the voting process or no interest in it. In fact, she'd completed a Master of Arts in a period in jail. In terms of the arguments, the plaintiff had two broad arguments. One was that no group of citizens, at least, capable of voting should be constitutionally be able to be denied the vote. The second were arguments trying to draw on an implied right of political communication or association, and again, the High Court wasn't particularly interested in that second raft of arguments. On the other side, the Solicitor General had, putting it very, very broadly, arguments that people who offend so significantly that under systems where imprisonment is meant to be last resort, they are jailed, have effectively absented themselves from the people, which tees up with a kind of social contract argument. The broader argument is that the court, High Court, should defer to Parliament, except perhaps in the most egregious cases, such as disenfranchising women or people on the basis of race and so on. Now, most pundits, I think myself and George Williams, amongst others, thought that it was unlikely the High Court would find for the plaintiff, Ms. Roach. On the other hand, if you looked at it more deeply, the Solicitor General had a difficult task to argue because the disenfranchisement was so complete. The Commonwealth had to argue that, in effect, there was to be a space for inter terrorum or egregious disenfranchisements where the High Court should come in on the back of its white horse and save us from a government that was so sexist or racist or as to, for example, in Marion Gleeson's example, exclude all Catholics from the right to vote. So the High Court had to preserve a principle for itself where it could guard against the worst possible excesses of an undemocratic or discriminatory parliament. But on the other hand, where was the line then to be drawn? To ensure that Parliament still was effectively in control of electoral law. In the outcome, a majority decision, with these judges in the majority, said that any blanket ban on prisoner voting was unconstitutional. As a result, the law reverted to the status quo, the 3-year rule. So some congratulations must be extended to the council in this case, I think some of whom might be here today, Messrs. Merkel, Forsyth and Associate Professor Walker, as well as Phil Lynch, who was one of the driving solicitors from the Victorian Public Interest Law Clearinghouse, because they succeeded in a partial victory that certainly confounded some of the pundits like myself. But the net result was that Vicky Roach was not allowed to vote in the last election because her sentence of 6 years was obviously longer than the status quo rule of 3 years. So what we've got ultimately is a compromise outcome from the bench. The lead judgment is really that of Justices Gummow, Kirby and Crennan, and my reading of it is it seems to stitch together arguments that we would associate with Justice Gummow, his historicism, in particular arguments drawing on the colonial disqualification rule and the Founding Fathers' intention or the drafting principles behind the disqualification in the Constitution, section 44.2, which says that no one can be an MP who is serving a sentence where the maximum penalty would be 1 year or more. So the Constitution has a rule that says you can still be an MP even if you've been convicted of a relatively minor offence. But Parliament had come along and said, we won't let anyone vote who's been convicted or is under sentence and in prison for even the most relatively minor of offences. The lead judgment also contains elements of, obviously, of Justice Kirby's approach to protection of human rights and also of vulnerable people, of whom you might think prisoners are a class. And indeed, the lead judgment uses the word stigmatisation, which I'm just speculating, but I think it might have come from the pen of Justice Kirby. Ultimately, the lead judgment rests on this idea that disenfranchising all prisoners, including for what you might call minor sentences of imprisonment, is disproportionate or not reasonably and appropriately adapted to a legitimate end, for example, of expressing the identity of the polity or of sending out signals about wrongdoing. The other judge in the majority is Chief Justice Gleeson, who's tempered his normal approach, normally fairly literal approach. He emphasised he does prefer parliamentary sovereignty, including in matters such as the shaping of the law of elections and democracy. But in this particular instance, an original intent reading would be unacceptable. So he follows, in a sense, the McTiernan and Jacob line that would say Parliament cannot go back to 1901 and assume that universal suffrage is still up for grabs. The idea of the people, directly chosen by the people in section 7 and 24, therefore has a shifting denotation. Its content can shift over time. And looking in particular at some statistics about imprisonment and incarceration, His Honour found that the blanket disenfranchisement was arbitrary. It didn't necessarily express a genuine statement about the culpability of the offender if someone who maybe was sentenced under a mandatory sentencing rule, for example, would lose their right to vote. And then Justice Hayne and Justice Hayden, Justice Callan didn't participate in dissent. One of their strongest arguments was that where does this leave the High Court for the future? Appeals to common standards or the people or representative democracy and its implications are ultimately indeterminate and vague. Indeterminate and vague in ways that mean why is the High Court, why does it see itself as better than the political process to determine what is arbitrary and proportionate to understandings of modern democracy? And Justice Hayne also made the rhetorical question or point, do we really think that earlier elections prior to 2007 were somehow tainted because of the prison and disenfranchised rules that pertained in the past? Finally, in summation, to try and draw out some of the significance of the case, starting at the most particular and drawing out to the more general. Well, in particular, the states have to look at their prisoner voting laws, states like Western Australia, for one of two reasons. First reason is that some states, for administrative convenience, joint role-keeping, have provisions that simply mirror the federal franchise rules about disenfranchising prisoners, amongst others. Or more significantly, those state constitutions that are similarly structured with provisions about directly chosen by the people will have similar jurisprudence applied to them in the future. Reading the tea leaves of the decision, it looks from what the court's saying that a future Conservative government could wind the prisoner franchise back by perhaps a couple of years, from the current 3-year rule to a rule closer to the 1-year rule. More broadly, the Roach case is a shield. It's not a sword, to use that old metaphor. It's a shield against backtracking by future parliaments. Maybe, arguably, even in a decade or so's time, if a future parliament tried to wind back the voting rights of expatriate Australians, people who go overseas for up to 6 years now can continue their voting rights even in perpetuity if they stay more than 6 years. And a future High Court might say, well, that's become part of the common standard or common understandings of what is a minimum electoral franchise to have a representative democracy. But it's not a sword to expand the franchise. In other words, Roach's case couldn't be used to expand beyond what Parliament has done in the past, the right to vote to, say, non-citizen residents, people who pay taxes, permanent residents, who in Australia, unlike New Zealand and some other countries, have no say in elections. Ultimately, then, to sum it up, I'd say the moral of the case is simply this. The High Court is following behind but reinforcing the evolving democratic expansions that have been won in the political sphere. The High Court's not taking a proactive role as it has done, or its counterparts have done in other countries. Thanks, Anna.
I'm reminded of some of those wonderful American speakers you hear who seem to be able to pitch their entire paper, no matter what time it is, to within a few seconds of the allotted time. And I'd like to congratulate our first speaker for following that tradition. Our second speaker in this session is Stephen McLeish of the Victorian Bar, where he has practiced since 1993 in the fields of constitutional and administrative law, commercial law and equity, although he was admitted to practice in 1987. He has degrees from Melbourne University and, interestingly, a Master of Laws from Harvard, where He studied, not only did he study constitutional law with Professor Tribe, but he was also taught by Roberto Unger. And one of the twists of that is that he shared a class with Barack Obama on reinventing democracy. So I thought that if the questioning falls away on constitutional law, we can ask him to give us a characterisation of the man who may well be the next president of the United States, and he can share with us some of his insights in that regard. But in the meantime, he's going to talk to us about the limiting Commonwealth powers and the meaning of other than state insurance arising out of Attorney General Victoria and Andrews. This is the one case in which there is the common thread that Graham referred to does not exist, and this is of the three cases, this is the one where my former brother Ron Merkel did not appear. The paper that Stephen's going to present to us is about the way that the High Court and Andrews approached Section 5114 and the power of the Commonwealth to make laws with respect to insurance other than state insurance. He's going to explain to us what is a difficult leading judgment of the case, to save you reading it for yourselves, and then raise a concern about the approach to the characterisation which the judges took. Thank you, Mr. McLeish.
Thank you. I should begin by saying that I would have to concede that Barack Obama seems to have taken a lot more away from Roberto Unger's reinventing democracy subject than I have. And I don't really welcome any further questions on that subject. Andrews was decided in March 2007. And as you've heard this morning, it concerned Commonwealth legislation which purported to enable Optus to elect to be subject to the Commonwealth Workers' Compensation Scheme instead of the Victorian one. The argument against the validity of the legislation, advanced at first instance by the Victorian Work Cover Authority and then on appeal by the Victorian Attorney General intervening, relied on Section 5114 of the Constitution. You've also heard that it's a difficult case and it is also about insurance, but I'm going to try and ease gently into the statutory background to get to the rather perplexing way in which the joint judgment approached its characterisation task. Section 5114 contains an unusual limitation. It empowers the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws with respect to insurance other than state insurance. Also state insurance extending beyond the limits of the state concerned. But it's unusual because it contains a restriction within the grant of power, in those words, other than state insurance. The argument against validity was that the Commonwealth laws in question were laws with respect to state insurance, or at least that they weren't laws with respect to insurance other than state insurance. On the face of it, the argument seems strong. After all, Section 108A7A, which is the first of the three provisions under attack of the Safety, Rehabilitation and Compensation Act 1988 of the Commonwealth, provided that if a corporation in the position of Optus became authorised to accept liability to pay compensation under the Commonwealth Act and then became liable upon an injury to a worker, then no state or territory law relating to workers' compensation applied to Optus in respect of injuries suffered by its employees, including that injury, but after it became licensed. It appears at first blush that this provision is a law with respect to state workers' compensation laws, which themselves, of course, regularly make provision for insurance to meet the liabilities they create. And in the case of Victoria, they also require that the insurance be taken out with a statutory body established by the state for the purpose. Justice Kirby, with whom Justice Callanan substantially agreed, held that the Commonwealth provisions were laws with respect to state insurance. Justice Callanan's, he added some comments, but there's a refreshing directness about His Honour's approach to the task of characterisation. His Honour said, "There is no doubt, in my opinion, that the laws in question are largely and substantially laws with respect to insurance and relevantly state insurance. I therefore agree with the reasons and conclusions of Justice Kirby." In comparison, the leading judgment of Justices Gummow, Hayden and Crennan engaged in a very elaborate analysis of both the Commonwealth Act and the State Act. And it's Their Honour's approach to the State Act, which I suggest is troubling. Going back to the legislation itself, Optus was a licensed corporation for the purposes of Part 8 of the Commonwealth Act. And in short, that meant that as a corporation in competition with a former Commonwealth authority, namely Telstra, it had been licensed by Comcare under Section 104(1) of the Commonwealth Act and authorised under Section 108(1), which they're the other two provisions under challenge, to accept liability for compensation claims under the Commonwealth Act in respect of injury, etc., to its employees. Just to make it clear what accepting liability meant, Section 108 capital A 1 said that if a licensed corporation was authorised to accept liability for an injury and there was an injury, then the corporation was liable. And as I've already mentioned, Section 108A 7A provided that no state or territory law relating to workers' compensation then applied in respect of injuries to the licensed corporation's employees. Now, the Commonwealth Act did not require a licensed corporation such as Optus to take out insurance. In that sense, it was a self-insurer. It did impose liability both for compensation or for actions for damages modified in the ways that workers' compensation legislation regularly modifies common law liability, in particular by a cap of $110,000. Those challenging the legislation sought a declaration that the three provisions were invalid to the extent that they removed the obligation of a licensed corporation to insure under the Victorian workers' compensation regime and to pay compensation and damages of common law under that regime. So the form of relief sought was specific to the Victorian regime, but I'll be coming back to that point. It appears to have been used as a justification by the joint judgment for an elaborate investigation of the Victorian regime in the context of Section 109. First, though, Section 51(14) of the Constitution has a parallel head of power in Section 51(13), which is a power to make laws with respect to banking other than state banking. And that was considered in a unanimous judgment of the court in Burke and State Bank of New South Wales in 1990. Now, that's not the easiest judgment either, but certain matters had been established in that case, and it was accepted on all sides that the same principles applied by parity of reasoning when one moved from banking to insurance. So Burke and through it, or Andrews and through it Burke, then stands for the following propositions. Firstly, there's no exclusive state power preventing Commonwealth law from touching or affecting state insurance. The words other than state insurance do not give the states exclusive power in respect of state insurance. Secondly, however, there is a restriction on Commonwealth legislative power, namely that any law that can be characterised as a law with respect to insurance must, in order to be valid, be a law with respect to insurance other than state insurance. That's been held to mean that any interference with state insurance must be so incidental as not to affect the character of the law as one with respect to insurance other than state insurance, which is perhaps circular, but it focuses on the question of the incidental effect on state insurance. Thirdly, and mirroring those first two propositions, if a law is not one with respect to state with respect to insurance, then it isn't subject to a restriction that it must not touch or concern state insurance. The first question is whether the law is one with respect to insurance. If it is, in order to be valid, it must be a law with respect to insurance other than state insurance. Fourthly, the fact that a law might be characterised as a law with respect to another head of power, such as in this case trading or financial corporations, does not avoid the restriction. As long as it's a law with respect to insurance, the restriction applies. Burke also held that state banking meant the business of banking conducted by a bank owned or controlled by a state. Most members of the court in Andrews didn't need to define state insurance because the The joint judgment didn't get to that point, but those that did adopted a corresponding meaning. In Burke itself, Section 52 of the Trade Practices Act, in its operation to the banking activities of the Bank of State Bank of New South Wales, not extending beyond New South Wales, was held invalid. That was because it was a law with respect to banking, essentially because the statutory definition of corporation in the Trade Practices Act expressly included a bank. And then it touched or concerned state banking in a more than incidental way by affecting the way state banks did business. So it was a law with respect to banking, but not a law with respect to banking other than state banking. Now, were the challenge provisions laws with respect to insurance? As I mentioned earlier, the Commonwealth Act didn't impose any insurance requirement upon the licensee. It was part of the application process for becoming licensed evidence about an ability to meet claims had to be provided. So to that extent, it might be said that the provisions weren't laws with respect to insurance at all. However, Justice Kirby records it as a matter of agreement between the parties, and the transcript bears him out, that the provisions were properly characterised as laws with respect to insurance, presumably on the basis that the Commonwealth provisions imposing their own form of liability and Section 107A7A, which rendered inapplicable state laws relating to workers' compensation, operated so as to exclude insurance obligations in relation to the liabilities that otherwise arose under state law. However, as was pointed out more than once in oral argument, and not only in this case, the court does not feel constrained by what the parties agree, and at least not in constitutional cases, and the joint judgment bears that out, and it is at odds with the position that was at least initially agreed between the parties. The Chief Justice formed part of the majority, but His Honour was able to step around the insurance point. His Honour accepted, at least for the sake of argument, that the laws were laws with respect to insurance, but upheld them on the basis that although they detracted from the comprehensiveness of the Victorian scheme, the regime for that insurance was not state insurance. It wasn't a state-owned or controlled business. State insurance meant a state-owned or controlled business which undertook insurance, but the challenge laws did not regulate those insurance transactions or affect Victoria in its ability to conduct insurance business. Simply provided that one formally insured corporation, one class of formally insured corporations no longer needed to be insured. Now, the joint judgment. The first step in the reasoning which their honours took to the conclusion that the laws were not laws with respect to insurance at all, and I may be attributing the wrong reasons, but my reading of the judgment is that the provisions imposing liability on licensed corporations in the Commonwealth Act were valid laws under the Corporations Power, which provided for the liability of those corporations for injuries suffered by their employees without touching or concerning state insurance in any way. Once that liability was imposed, then although Section 108A7A purported to exclude state laws relating to workers' compensation, that provision applies only to the state laws left intact after the provisions imposing liability at Commonwealth level had nullified the state liability which the State Act provided for under Section 109. So leaving insurance to one side altogether, their honours looked at the Commonwealth provisions creating liability and said under Section 109 they remove the liability under the State Act. So when we go to the State Act to see what laws are excluded, the obligation to insure just has no operation. So it isn't excluded, it just has no operation. And as such, the Commonwealth laws were not laws with respect to insurance. Now, their honours went exhaustively through the kinds of liability that the State Act imposed and found that each of them was inconsistent with the Commonwealth liability. I won't go through those details, but in the end, They held that there was no obligation of a licensed corporation, or at least of Optus, to which the state acts attached any requirement to insure. They were then able to apply a familiar test of characterisation to say that the only rights, duties, powers and privileges which the Commonwealth Act changed after the operation of Section 109, regulated or abolished, were laws with respect to compensation, not laws with respect to insurance. As such, the challenge provisions of Part 8 were not laws with respect to insurance at all, and still less did they touch or concern state insurance. On the court's approach, the laws which operated by virtue of Section 109 were directly inconsistent with state insurance laws, yet, and under Section 109 they rendered those laws inoperative. Yet the court necessarily held that the laws that had that effect were not laws with respect to insurance. And herein lies the paradox, to use a polite term, because if the laws were directly inconsistent with state laws obliging an insurer, an employer, to take out particular insurance, it's difficult to see why that didn't make them laws with respect to insurance. And it's also perhaps artificial not to regard the purpose of the Commonwealth legislation as being to displace the state insurance regime. What then of Section 108A7A, which expressly displaced the state laws relating to workers' compensation? Given that those laws routinely provide for insurance, wasn't that at least a law with respect to insurance? The joint judgment said not. There being no insurance obligation left after Section 109 had done its work, Section 108A7A had no application to the insurance obligations for which the state law provided. Justice Kirby identified as the basic flaw in this reasoning the majority's willingness to separate the insurance and compensation provisions of the state and federal acts. His Honour criticised the joint judgment for ignoring the legal and practical interconnection between the substantive compensation provisions and the provisions for insurance or self-insurance that underpin both federal and state compensation schemes. His Honour held that the Commonwealth Act conferred on Optus an immunity from an obligation to insure with the state insurer. But since the Commonwealth Act didn't impose an insurance obligation, the need to look at the interrelationship between insurance and compensation really arose at state level. It's here that I would suggest with respect that there is a deeper difficulty in the majority's reasoning. Given that a law of the Commonwealth has been characterised, even though one that purports to exclude the application of state laws by reference to a statutory criterion relating to workers' compensation, what occasion is there as part of that process of characterisation to have regard to the state laws that may happen to be affected by that Commonwealth law? To have regard to those state laws and to apply Section 109 in relation to them, I'd suggest risks clouding the issue of legislative power in relation to the challenge provisions. The provisions were either a law with respect to insurance or not. They had their effect in relation to state laws relating to workers' compensation from time to time, irrespective of their content. And if the liability provisions of the Commonwealth Act had the effect that a licensee such as Optus was subject to a different insurance regime, then they arguably have the same operation as Section 108A7a. In argument, Victoria relied on an argument which is not found in the judgments, but with respect, it seems a telling one. In Carton-Yeary in the Commonwealth, Justice Gaudron cited with approval a statement made by Justice Dawson in Kimani and Captain Cook Cruises that a law which affects the repeal of another law is not a law with respect to repeal. Its subject matter is the subject matter of the law which is repealed. And equally, I would suggest a law which has the direct effect of rendering nugatory a state law with respect to insurance, irrespective of the content of that state law, is itself a law with respect to insurance. And if that point's reached, the question then turns to state insurance, and I don't have time to go into that aspect, but whether the court answered the particular characterisation question rightly or wrongly, the wider issue that the case raises, and its troubling aspect, to me at least, is the role that the court was prepared to give to the particular state laws in question in characterising the Commonwealth law. If a Commonwealth law is to be characterised according to its legal operation and effect and its purpose, that's a quality that the law has irrespective of the facts which have brought the matter before the court. And it's troubling, I would suggest, that the court appears to have confined its characterisation exercise and indeed been guided by it by reference to particular matters outside the statute. Thank you.
Well, we're doing wonderfully well sticking to time. I'd like to congratulate the two speakers so far, especially Stephen, because we all know that one of the great lies told in court is, Your Honour, this matter will be short. And that's probably why we should also congratulate him, because I've neglected to mention that he took silk in just in November 2007, and we can see why, because of the ability he's shown in dealing with elucidating for us reasonably complex judgments, which is even more interesting because he was also junior counsel in the Thomas and Mowbray case, which explains why he was asked to speak on Andrews. However, we do have Professor Geoffrey Lindell to speak to us now on the scope of defence and other powers arising out of Thomas and Mowbray. Professor Lindell is an adjunct professor of law at the Adelaide and Australian National Universities and a professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne. Before his retirement as a full-time academic in 2002, he held senior academic positions at the ANU and also at the University of Melbourne. He's taught and published widely in the field of Australian constitutional law and has a particular interest in government and history. He's assisted in some major reviews of the Australian Constitution, as well as having provided and continuing to provide legal and constitutional advice to governments and parliaments. He's appeared as counsel in High Court constitutional cases and was until 2002 the inaugural secretary of the Australian Association of Constitutional Law, a body he helped to form. And he was co-opted as a member of the council of that association during 2005. I'd like to welcome Professor Lindell.
Thank you very much, Judge. There's nothing new about terrorism, as avid readers of the reports of the Cabinet Papers for 1977 will recall, when they were reminded of the terrorist threat posed by the Indian Ananda Marga sect and the bombing of the Hilton Hotel. The bombing occurred during the meeting of the Commonwealth Heads of State in 1978 and resulted in the deaths of three people. Three sect members were convicted of offences arising out of that incident, and also the murder of the leader of the National Front, even though those convictions were quashed on appeal, except for one sect member who saw out his sentence for the Hilton bombing incident. These cases were, of course, dealt with under the ordinary criminal law. So why was it found necessary in 2003 to take more drastic legal action to address terrorism? It will be argued by some that the answer can be found in the allegedly different nature of modern terrorism, as was graphically exemplified by the events of the 11th of September 2001 and recent terrorist events in a number of places, including Bali, Madrid and London. Well, the issue addressed in Thomas and Mowbray was the power of the Commonwealth Parliament to deal with the threat of terrorism, especially given the absence of specific powers to deal with that subject or the general criminal law, both of which obviously come within state legislative power. I deal first with a position which was thought to exist before Mowbray was decided. It is true that the Constitution in Section 119, as Professor Tooney explained, obliges the Commonwealth to protect every state against domestic violence. But this, of course, only arises if the executive government of the state seeks the assistance of the Commonwealth. That, however, is still important because the obligation may assume that there is authority to use military forces under the defence power in Section 51(6) in order to perform the obligation. I say that because of the other provisions in 114 which prevent the states from raising or maintaining their own military forces without the consent of the Commonwealth. But the Hilton bombing case highlighted, of course, the absence of any need for the Commonwealth to rely on its obligation to protect the states where the Commonwealth's own interests and authority is involved. I have here in mind Section 61, the executive power of the Commonwealth, when read in conjunction with the incidental powers of legislation in 5139, and the myriad of other powers of legislation in Sections 51 and 52, including, of course, the external affairs power, which would have had a particular significance to that Commonwealth Heads of State meeting that I mentioned earlier. That kind of authority has long been acknowledged both in the United States and Australia. But the assumption made about the defence power was that it was confined to dealing with external threats or enemies, or so I said to my students for many, many years. The internal threats, or such as treason and subversion, fell within the power of the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws that were incidental to the execution of the Commonwealth executive power under Section 5139 and 61, and also whatever was encompassed by the implied nationhood power to protect existing governments and governmental institutions from internal violence, what might be termed as the self-preservation power. Finally, to complete the picture, in 2003, the states referred power over terrorism to the Commonwealth under Section 5137, and at the time I thought that that would neatly avoid the sort of questions that I have to talk about today. A brief word about the facts of the case. Thomas, the plaintiff, admitted to having undertaken training, including weapons training, at a camp of a listed terrorist organisation in 2001. In order to protect the public from an apprehended terrorist attack, the first defendant in the case, who was a federal magistrate, made an interim control order against him under the Criminal Code in Division 104, or more particularly Section 104.4. The plaintiff was ordered to remain at his place of residence between midnight and 5 o'clock each morning, report to the police 3 times each week, submit to fingerprinting, and he was also prohibited from leaving Australia, communicating with certain named individuals, and using certain communications technology, as well as acquiring or manufacturing explosives. The magistrate held that without these controls, the plaintiff's knowledge and skills could have provided a potential resource for the planning or preparation of a terrorist act. The plaintiff then commenced proceedings in the High Court to quash the interim control order on the basis that Division 104 of the Code was wholly invalid. I will only deal with the power aspect and not Chapter 3, which will be dealt with after lunch. In particular, I'll be concerned with whether the challenge provisions under which the order was made fell within the defence power and the incidental and implied nationhood powers, and also the external affairs and referral powers. As to the challenge legislative provisions themselves, they were, obviously enough, directed at terrorism, which was defined to consist of a variety of actions or threats of actions which involve violence against persons and damage to property and the disruption of public services and utilities, where the action or threat of action is made with the intention of advancing a political, religious or ideological cause. But there were other conditions attached to the description of terrorism. It had to be either undertaken in order to coerce or influence by intimidation governments of Australia or a foreign country, or to intimidate the public or a section of the public. So you'll notice that it isn't just violence by itself, it's violence accompanied with this intention of advancing a political, religious or ideological cause with those other two intentions that I mentioned. The legislation authorised the Australian Federal Police to seek the making of an interim control order with the consent of the Attorney-General, and the order could be made if a federal magistrate was satisfied on the balance of probability that the order would substantially assist in preventing a terrorist act, or that the person against whom the order is sought had provided training to or received training from a listed terrorist organisation. And all of this, if the making of the order, and here come those nice words, was reasonably necessary and reasonably appropriate and adapted for the purpose of protecting the public from a terrorist act. Fair mouthful. That's why you have a handout. Now, it is worth emphasising here 3 features of this legislation. In the first place, As Dr. Andrew Lynch and others who edited a book on terrorism recently indicated, Australia has followed the model of defining terrorism by reference to the intention or motive of the person engaged in the terrorist activity. We can distinguish here the pursuit of violence for public and private ends. When we talk about violence for public ends, then of course we have the ends referred to in the Commonwealth legislation, political, religious or ideological. When we undertake violence for private ends, we presumably do so these days in a way that would still be covered by state law, such as violence for personal profit, greed, jealousy, animosity and personal and family conflicts. The second feature I'd like to stress is that the challenge provisions did not create offences as such with respect to terrorism. That had been dealt with elsewhere, but instead only authorised restrictions on personal liberty. And that was in order to prevent the commission of such offences in the future. It's what the Chief Justice, Justice Murray Gleeson, thought Blackstone would have described as preventative justice. Thirdly, it is crucial to note the essential involvement of the judiciary in all of this, which is important not only to the issue that I deal with, but also for Chapter 3. The provisions here, to use the words of Sir Owen Dixon's, did not impose an administrative control of liberty because you had to get the approval of the court to order these restrictions. I turn now to the result of the challenge regarding the scope of the relevant powers and their exposition. A majority of the court, with Justice Kirby dissenting, upheld them as an exercise of the defence power. The challenge provisions were upheld as falling within the central conception of the power, as Professor Toomey emphasised, and this was so without the need to resort to further facts necessary to attract what is referred to as the extended or secondary aspect of the defence power, the kind of thing that was needed to support the economic measures that were passed during World War II. The Chief Justice, Justices Gummow and Crennan, and to a lesser extent Justice Haynes, took this view, which was joined by Justices Callan and Hayden, at least implicitly, except that they seem to place a bit more reliance on notorious facts concerning the nature of international terrorism. In any event, the majority's clear view is that the power is not limited to, and that is the defence power, of course, or confined to dealing with external threats, waging war in a conventional sense, or the protection of bodies politic as distinct from the public that they're supposed to represent. Now, although I've thought about this for a while, I don't think on reflection that this was based only on self-assertion motivated by an understandable fear of terrorism. Although it isn't stressed in the case, the concept of defence does not stipulate the entity or the body against whom action is taken to defend or resist attack. But amongst the reasons that were relied on by the majority were self-defence at international law, the use of military forces to quell internal and civil disturbances such as strikes and riots in English legal history, Alexander Hamilton's understanding of defence, the critical difficulty, and this I think is quite important, of separating governments from the people they're supposed to represent and protect, as was witnessed with the bombing of the civilian populations in World War II. From an analytical perspective, reference was also made to Section 119, dealing with domestic violence, as it does, and the second limb of the defence power itself, when it refers to legislation for the control of the forces to execute and maintain the laws of the Commonwealth. Now, the reliance on that second limb, which hitherto didn't seem to me to receive much attention, highlights the relevance of the power to what I'll describe as internal disturbances, even though it only refers in that respect to use of the forces to execute and maintain the laws of the Commonwealth, not the states. This may well indicate that the words of both limbs of the power now are treated as words of extension and not limitation. Remember, the Air Force, for example, isn't mentioned in naval and military defence. Now, we need to compare that with the approach of Justice Kirby, who, although he dissented, accepted that the power included the ability to protect federal and state governments from internal threats, but, it seems, not their public, in the absence of any evidence to support the operation of the extended aspect of the defence power, and the Commonwealth hadn't adduced enough evidence to show that that was in play. He construed the power in the context of a number of other powers which referred to naval and military defence, and also the provisions of sections 114 and 119 as giving rise to precisely the contrary inference to that drawn by the majority. He also stressed the existence of state police powers, which in my view came dangerously close to assuming an implied reservation of such a power in favour of the states. What, if my charge is well founded, Sir Anthony Mason would once have described as a deviation from the true faith. Now, the only judge who found it necessary to discuss the incidental and national implied powers of self-preservation was, of course, Justice Kirby, who would have confined these notions to laws to preserve and protect the constitutional structures and institutions of Australian governments as political entities. Now, this is another matter on which I've thought about fairly carefully. Subject to two possible qualifications, I think on reflection that it probably doesn't matter whether one locates this terrorist power in the defence power or those incidental powers, those nationhood powers that I talk about. Both powers are, after all, purposive and will involve difficult questions of degree and also proportionality, but with a much lower degree of judicial scrutiny than is usually encountered with other powers. The one qualification to that point, the possible qualification, might be that perhaps it is thought that the scope of the terrorism power may be wider if it does not rest on any notion of implication or incidentality. And there may also be another difference, which is mentioned in the written version of my speaking notes, which will become available later when I discuss the principle established in the Communist Party case. The Chief Justice, Justices Gummow and Crennan, would have upheld the provisions as an exercise of the external affairs power in relation to terrorist acts that are directed against foreign governments and their people to the extent that they didn't already fall within the defence power. So they took the precaution of relying on the external affairs power for that limited purpose. They did that as by relying on that aspect of the power that enables the Commonwealth to legislate with respect to any places, persons, matters or things geographically external to Australia. This seems to me to have been an unnecessary and slight extension of the geographically external notion, since the terrorist action or threat included such behaviour when it actually took place in Australia. It was unnecessary because I would have thought there was ample authority to support the law under the external affairs power as being relevant to dealing with the friendly or other relations with foreign governments and their people. Justice Kirby, of course, in his dissent, denied the availability of this and other aspects of the external affairs power. Now, only Justices Hayne and Kirby found it necessary to determine whether the challenge provisions could also be upheld as an exercise of the referral power. Under this power, the Commonwealth Parliament may make laws with respect to matters referred to it by the Parliament or Parliaments of any state or states. The Victorian Parliament had, in common with other state parliaments, referred to the Commonwealth two matters: a scheduled text of provisions with respect to terrorism, and in addition, the matter of terrorist acts or actions relating to terrorist acts, so long as the law made operates only as an express amendment of the scheduled text, and the issue was whether the challenge provisions satisfied that latter proviso. Was it just merely an amendment of the scheduled text? Justice Hayne thought the challenge provision satisfied that proviso, while Justice Kirby reached the opposite conclusion. The issue regarding amendment is familiar in Anglo-Australian law. It arises in a variety of different statutory and constitutional contexts, and its resolution in the present constitutional context will have an important bearing on similar references made by the states which were designed to tightly confine their scope. Suffice it to say that both judges were in disagreement on the issue here for a reason which is elaborated in the written version of these notes. Justice Kirby also denied that the challenge provisions came within the referred matter because the provisions in the referred schedule text concerned the regulation, definition and punishment of terrorist acts, not the mere prevention of terrorist acts or the protection of the public from potential terrorist acts. In other words, the reference didn't actually authorise this kind of preventative justice, putting people away for what they might do rather than what they've already done. Justice Kirby also relied on the presumption against altering fundamental common law rights in the absence of an explicit intention by the State Parliament to override rights of that character. In other words, he applied that well-known common law presumption to state legislation which refers matters to the Commonwealth under section 5137. This then required the referred matter to be read narrowly because of the need to protect personal liberty. It gives rise to an interesting question whether, unlike the plenary constitutional powers given to the Commonwealth Parliament, plenary within a highly qualified sense, to the Commonwealth Parliament under sections 51 and 52, the powers of state parliaments to refer matters should be constrained by presumptions that normally apply to the interpretation of ordinary legislation. This could, for example, affect whether the referred legislation passed by the Commonwealth Parliament can be made to operate retrospectively in the absence of a clear intention of the State Parliament to permit such an operation. Justices Haynes and Kirby did manage to agree on one matter, and that was the ineffectiveness of section 100.8 of the Criminal Code. This provision purported to require the approval of a majority of states and territories for any changes to be made to that part of the legislation which contained the challenge provisions. Their reason was, of course, the familiar principle that the Commonwealth Parliament is unable to bind its successors regarding the manner and form which governs the making of a law. In the course of argument, as the transcript shows, Justice Gummow went further and seemed to hint that this principle could not be evaded by the states conditioning the reference in that way. This is so despite the apparent latitude allowed by the High Court regarding the ability of a state to define the content and the duration of any referred matter. At any rate, these are the sorts of issues that may require resolution someday because of their bearing on the numerous forms of cooperative arrangements entered into between the Commonwealth and the states. Now to the relevance of the Communist Party case. As Alex Riley and others have had occasion to observe, the case has been much touted, and in recent times not least by Justice Kirby himself, as an example of the High Court's potential to protect civil liberties and the rule of law through its authority to interpret the extent of Commonwealth legislative power. A surprising aspect of the case was the somewhat gratuitous criticism levelled at the Communist Party case by Justice Callinan and the strong defence mounted in support of that case by Justice Kirby, who asserted in his dissent was consistent with the conclusion and approach adopted by the majority in that case. This could be misleading if it was read as suggesting that the conclusion reached by the majority in Thomas and Mowbray was inconsistent with the actual principle established in the Communist Party case. As will be seen, the majority and I have little difficulty in concluding that the legislation did not breach that principle. Professor Leslie Zions has succinctly summarised it in the following terms. Except in the case of the defence power during a time of war or emergency, the constitutional validity of a law or of an administrative act cannot be made to depend upon the opinion of the Parliament, Government or any other person that the law or act is within or relates to the subject matter of a legislative power. As Justice Fullagar in the Communist Party case famously observed, the power to make laws with respect to lighthouses is not what the Parliament or anyone else happens to conclusively think is a lighthouse. And the reason for that is obvious enough. That opinion may well be mistaken and thus give the law or administrative act an operation that travels outside power. The law must be framed in such a way as to ensure the courts can determine whether the law or administrative act under review comes within power. The challenge provisions operated here by reference to the opinion of a judicial body as to whether the making of an interim control order was reasonably necessary to prevent the commission of a terrorist act or threat. They did not operate by reference to the conclusive opinion of the Parliament or the Governor-General in Council, as did the provisions found invalid in the Communist Party case. Thus, as Justice Haynes emphasised, there was no administrative control of the liberty of the individual here. Nothing in this case indicates whether it would have upheld the making of the same order or orders for the detention on the sole authority of the executive or administrative officials without the possibility of judicial review on the need for the making of the order. It will be recalled that the majority judges were able to sustain the challenge provisions without requiring the Commonwealth to adduce evidence of facts necessary to support the extended aspect of the defence power. This made it unnecessary to undertake a detailed discussion of the kind of evidence that can be adduced to prove constitutional facts. But should that arise in the future, there is a comprehensive analysis of that issue in the judgment of Justice Hayden, which repays close analysis, even if it is not fully accepted by Justice Kirby. To conclude, the rule of law underpins the principle in the Communist Party case by ensuring the judicial review of law and administrative action. What this case showed, if it needed to be showed, is that laws made under sections 51 and 52 of the Constitution, and presumably state laws as well, may provide for preventative justice, which I would have thought contradicted one of the elements of the rule of law formulated by Professor Dicey. What I've said in that regard, of course, is subject to Chapter 3, but I'm happy to leave that topic to another speaker to address whether the challenge provisions breach that part of the Constitution. And I'm sorry to have spoiled our record.
I don't think you've spoiled the record, really, because the real factor is that you had so many different aspects of power to deal with that I thought you did it brilliantly in the time available. And I'm sure that everyone will look forward to the written version of Professor Lindell's speaking notes, which will be available later. Now it's time to open this session up to questions. So questions or comments, I should say. So, and I gather we now have roving microphones, so we'll all be able to hear the question. Do I see any hands? Where? Over there. Oh, Michael.
Michael Sexton. Perhaps I was going to make a comment on Roach, and then Professor Orr might like to make a comment on my comment. I was going to suggest that Roach is perhaps, in modern times, one of the decisions of the court that has the least analysis of the principles on which the decision is supposed to be based. I don't have any particular quarrel with the result. It's true that a number of the states, including New South Wales, went along to the case and supported the Commonwealth, even though New South Wales's legislation wasn't in the same terms as the Commonwealth, and arguably the Commonwealth legislation did have an element of overkill about it. But when you look at the majority's decision, you ask yourself, for example, why is the figure of 3 years arrived at? Why not 2 years? Why not 4 years? There's simply no explanation as to how any of this occurs. It seems to me one of the most poorly argued of the court's decisions of the majority in recent times, and I would have thought that the dissenters had very much the better of the reasoning, even if one takes the view that there's something desirable about the final result. So perhaps I wonder if Professor Orr would like to comment on that.
I think that's a fair comment, Michael. We're left with these vague notions about what degree of culpability might be sufficient, and why it should be up to the court to make those line drawing decisions and not simply trust it. The political process isn't clear. I mean, it seems to me if the government or Senator Betts had drafted the legislation, made it 1 year or 6 months, then the court would have been in a real difficult position. You're right to say that it was simply the overkill of getting a blanket ban on anyone who happened to be in jail for an offence at the time of the election or the closing of the rolls were disenfranchised. That was that kind of overkill that made the job of the Solicitor General very difficult ultimately.
Thank you. I think David has that.
Yes, I just had a brief comment on Stephen McLeish's helpful paper on Andrews. And that is this, that there's one much simpler way of justifying the result in that case, which one can read into the judgment to some extent. And that is this. You start with Burke, which says that state insurance or state banking means banking or insurance by a state instrumentality of some sort. You then say, well, the effect of 5114 is that Commonwealth power extends to all other insurance by everyone else, and what is carved out
is insurance by state agencies. The state then passes a law giving the Victorian Work Cover Authority, in that case, a monopoly in a particular area. Now, very simply, in the division I've just put, that is not a law about state insurance at all. It's a law about every other insurance company. If one says VWA has a monopoly, that says nothing about VWA. It just says no one else can do it. And that is the reason why the area of saying, well, you don't have a monopoly, you can insure with anyone else, is squarely within the concurrent area of insurance other than state insurance, and not within the exclusion of state insurance. If one puts it that way, one can cut through the complexity which the decision otherwise has and get to the result much more simply. And as I say, there are hints of that in the judgments themselves.
Do you want to comment on that, Steve?
Yes, I agree with those observations, and in fact I think there's a lot of support, especially in the Chief Justice's judgment, for that approach to go straight to the state insurance question. I must say I'm a little troubled by the emphasis Justice Kirby placed on the monopoly of the state insurer, because, again, to me that seems to be looking at facts which happen to be particular to Victoria and are fortuitous whether or not there's a state monopoly, whereas the characterisation of the Commonwealth laws ought to proceed without needing to get into those levels of detail. So certainly the quicker way to get to the result is accepting, as the parties did, that it's a law with respect to insurance, but then along the lines David's just said, saying that they were nonetheless not laws with respect to state insurance.
Thank you.
Okay, I understand their point, Kim, that there might be some attempt to argue by the Southern Cross Group or others that there's an underlying right to vote constitutionally protected because the people of Australia include people who are, at least say they're temporarily outside Australia, but otherwise Australian citizens and have connections with family and home in a globalised world, and that therefore any excess or too stringent procedural hurdles and requirements for them to exercise that franchise to through formal processes stay on the roll might be unconstitutional. I think that would be a step to beyond the kind of very cautious approach of Roche, but it'd be quite interesting to see that that argued and take what could be a bit of a, well, it might be a big Pandora's box, but it'll be a And if I could follow on to what Michael's question, but what I didn't really touch on, at least in the oral presentation, was the paucity in the majority's reasoning to me is the unwillingness to adopt what you might call a strict scrutiny approach, take a sort of that American idea and say, look, we will be particularly vigilant when it comes to electoral rules because you can't necessarily trust the children in charge of the lolly shop, the politicians. To shape rules which they obviously have a direct partisan interest in. And it's that lack of a what you might call a realpolitik understanding of the realities, of the reasons why certain electoral rules are in place that is missing from the High Court, and probably because the High Court has had a century-long reluctance to get involved in matters that are so intensely capital P political.
Thanks, Graham. It's very hard in this light to see hands, so if you could... yes, thank you. Thanks, Peter. And thanks for the lights.
Like an Ashby and White, I think, argument. No, I don't think. I haven't really considered that, but I would very much doubt it. She would have had a right to vote that would have had to been immediately activated. But my limited understanding of the High Court's jurisprudence on constitutional damages is no, but I could be wrong.
I wouldn't say necessarily wrong. Certainly, the right wouldn't arise under the Constitution, but given that its existence at common law, that if you do interfere with people's right to vote under Ashby and White, as long as nothing had been done to erode the common law right, then it would have operated on the fact of invalidity of the legislation. All those Section 92 cases where Mr. Jones was able to use trespass and all that sort of thing.
It would be interesting to see how you value that.
I just wonder.
Denial of the right.
Yes, up the back.
Jeremy Kirk of the Sydney Bar. A comment posing as a question for Jeff. One thing that might be said as the Gleeson-Gummo period comes to an end and the pendulum starts to swing back is that textualism and formalistic reasoning have been evident over the last decade or so. I don't necessarily say that critically. However, when it comes to cases such as this and the result, and when one looks back at the text which you've helpfully included, Jeff, in your handout, the text of Section 51(6) relevantly speaks of the naval and military defence of the Commonwealth and of the several states. In other words, it's not defence simpliciter, it is defence by particular means, naval and military means. Now, I can understand how it might be said in World War II that to have control of the economy is incidental to the military defence of Australia. It's a bit difficult, however, to see how restricting action undertaken with the intention of intimidating a state government or the public has anything to do with the naval or military defence of the Commonwealth. Might this decision perhaps best be seen, therefore, as showing that even for this rather formalistic and textual period of Australian constitutional jurisprudence, there is still the potential for evolution of an understanding of the Constitution to respond to a very modern understanding of a problem, namely terrorism, which has achieved a particular significance in the events of the last 6 or 7 years. In other words, even for this court, there is great scope for an evolutionary view of what the Constitution says.
Yes, well, that's certainly something to think about. I would not deny that there is scope for an evolutionary approach, and it's going on now, no matter how one disguises it through analytical considerations or anything else. It's a dynamic. It's a bit like the case that was sometimes made by people who supported economic analysis of the law, that it's going to happen, whether or not people have read Posner's book, I suppose. Well, to get back to the point about the how persuasive is it to rely on analytical considerations here, given the point that Jeremy is making, it's certainly a very strong one. But I think the cat was let out of the bag in Ferry and Vivette. And that's the significance of those, what I meant when I talked about both limbs of Section 51(6) now being treated as words of extension rather than words of limitation. In the same way that Ferry and Bovet took the view that naval and military was not going to constrain the concept of defence, what do you base that on? Not entirely sure, unless you go back to utilitarian considerations, someone's own view about how governments can perform. I think Justice Cowan, of all people, is in fact perhaps the most honest in coming straight out and assuming that it's the Commonwealth that can do this better than the states. He says it in a line of his judgment. I thought, and this gave me quite a lot of difficulty, was this just self-assertion in order to meet something that isn't stated on the face of the judgment? On balance, I did come to the conclusion that it wasn't, based on the previous authorities, but I would have to concede that the analytical considerations can go one way or the other, as is illustrated by Justice Kirby's dissent. On the one hand, you have judges saying, well, this too can be words of limitation. This aspect of the defence power can operate in that way. But he actually comes along and says, well, no, no, Section 119 actually limits the extent to which you can deal with internal disturbances. So there is a problem with the analytical considerations. But now let me come to the factor that is mentioned in the majority judgment, apart from the one that I mentioned, which defence doesn't really tell you against whom you're defending, and that is the difficulty of distinguishing between protecting governments, and remember Justice Kirby does acknowledge that you can do that under the defence power, and their people. I thought at the end of the day that was a very difficult distinction to run, so that if you're looking for a pragmatic consideration, which on this occasion isn't hidden, it is mentioned in the judgments, probably that might tip the balance.
I think we have time for one more question. Well, I'm going to ask one very quick one then, to Stephen, if I may. Stephen, in his dissent in Andrews, Justice Kirby said that there are obvious resonances with the decision in the work choices case, and that the result demonstrates the constitutionally disruptive journey that began with that case. Do you have any comment to make on that suggestion?
I think what Justice Kirby is referring to there is the argument in work choices, which was unsuccessful, to the effect that the industrial disputes power contains within it an implied restriction on the power of the Commonwealth to legislate under other heads of power in a way that circumvents all the jurisprudence on industrial disputes extending beyond the limits of one state and so on. And I think His Honour was equating that implied limitation, which the court found didn't exist in work choices, with the express words other than state insurance in Andrews, and in each case saying that the federal balance had been disrupted. And His Honour was no doubt deliberately provocative in using that phrase, federal balance, in Andrews after it had been put to bed by the rest of the court in work choices. But it's... apart from the results, and maybe there's an unspoken assertion there that the majority is striving to extend Commonwealth power, but if one looks at the reasoning, the court in Andrews didn't say that there's no restriction or that the aspect of the federal balance that was at stake in work choices didn't exist in Andrews. It recognised it. It just found that it wasn't applicable in that case. So I don't... in a sort of general trend sense, yes, there are two decisions in which the court's gone to some lengths to reach a result which has upheld federal power, but I don't really see it as as two cases in which the analysis is especially similar.
Thank you. I think Graham just wants to add one observation on that.
Well, just because I have to teach labour law and torts, the question I've been thinking of is Andrews and work choices together, as far as I can see, gives a green light to the Commonwealth to not just trash the procedural and substantive rules of no-fault workers' compensation schemes, but also the whole common law framework of personal injuries for employees. And that might be a good thing as a teacher, because we'd like to have a uniform system, but it would have Justice Higgins turning horribly in his grave.
Well, at the risk of just going 1 minute over, I think Jeff wants to add one other observation.
Yes. I'm not sure whether this is allowed in the High Court, but there was just one other point that I should have made in reply to Jeremy. if, in fact, it is true that military forces were used to quell civil disturbances in English legal history, and I think it is, but if it is, and you're faced with a provision such as Section 114, which doesn't give the states the ability to use the military forces, does this not provide some analytical support for the notion that the Commonwealth's responsibilities do extend in that area?
Well, I am going to wrap it up now. That was a useful, very useful and helpful addendum. I think you'll agree with me. I'm not going to try and summarise this session for you. You've done the speakers have summarised their own, the cases with which they've dealt, and they've done it for us in a way that has made it succinct and interesting and comprehensive, and I'm sure you'd like to join with me in thanking them for the work they've put into it.